News Radio, I'm Kristen Welker at the White House. Much of the central Gulf Coast is underwater. NBC's Veronica De La Cruz has more.
Record amounts of rain have already fallen, and more may be on the way in Pensacola, Florida. Some residents may be forced from their homes.
Hoping it doesn't get up any higher. Walked out and it was already up to the porch.
The lake had blown out and here comes all this water and traps some people in.
Many of the areas hit are rural.
I got a couple of cows behind the barn. I was back there watching, making sure they weren't floating away.
Forecasters expect more showers and thunderstorms today and into Monday. One sheriff in the Florida Panhandle has declared a state of emergency. I'm Veronica De La Cruz, NBC News Radio.
Polls are open in France, where voting for the lower house of parliament begins. At stake is whether new President François Hollande's socialists will get control of government or their conservative rivals. A global conference celebrating Roman Catholicism is opening in Ireland. More than 20,000 are attending Sunday's open-air mass in Dublin. This is NBC News Radio. More violence in Syria today. NBC's Ayman Mouhaladeen reports the rebel strikes in Damascus are significant.
This isn't the first time explosions have rocked the capital, but what makes today's development so significant, it is a direct challenge to President Assad's grip on power in the seat of his power.
Gunfire also erupted in one coastal city where hundreds of rebels had set up base. It was a controversial outcome to Saturday's welterweight title fight.
Timothy Bradley promised a shock, but for many the biggest shock and his Saturday night welterweight title fight with Manny Pacquiao came from the judges' scorecards. Pacquiao seemed to have the fight in hand, but the Filipino fighter's remarkable 7-year unbeaten run ended when two judges gave Bradley a split decision. A loud din of boos came from the crowd at the MGM Grand Arena in Las Vegas. Pacquiao seemed stunned. Promoter Bob Arum fumed, "I'm going to make a lot of money on the rematch," he said, but this was outrageous. The rematch is set for November. Scott Carr, NBC News Radio.
More news at MSNBC.com. I'm Kristen Welker, NBC News Radio.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brings me to a shopping mall. Of course, when it comes to shopping for car insurance, most people go to GEICO. I mean, with all the discounts they offer, why would you shop anywhere else? There are discounts for complete and defensive driving courses, multi-policy discounts, and discounts for being accident-free. You know, this mall is a real maze. I think I passed that candle store about 5 times.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com to see how much you could save. GEICO, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
For over 150 years, Tag Heuer Swiss luxury watchmaker has brilliantly fused technology with design. And Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry, has an incredible selection to choose from.
That's Jared!
Time and again, Tag Heuer has revolutionized watchmaking with luxury timepieces, including the sleek avant-garde Link collection and the vintage appeal of the Carrera heritage. Now at Jared.
It can only be Jared!
Find a Jared store or shop anytime.
Here at Best Buy, we have expanded our selection of HD Radio car stereo receivers. New HD Radio car stereos are in store and offer you the best in digital entertainment and information. More music from local HD2, HD3 radio stations, iPhone, iPod control, digital traffic, iTunes tagging, and more. Best Buy has the leading brands, Alpine, Pioneer, Kenwood, JVC. Lots to choose from, with prices as low as $120. Here at Best Buy, we recommend HD Radio technology.
In the beloved fairy tale, Beauty and the Beast, Belle and the Beast learn that true beauty is found within and live happily ever after. Today, our happily ever afters are being threatened by the fact that nearly 1 in 3 children in America are overweight or obese. Now is the time to make good nutrition and physical activity part of your family's daily lifestyle. To learn more, visit letsmove.gov. Brought to you by Let's Move, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Ad Council.
Hey everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's longest-running and one and only food and wine variety show. Join us Sunday, June 17th. We're going to have a great show. The folks from Love and Carrots will be in. They come in and prepare and plant your garden for you. That ain't bad. The folks from the Howard Theater Gospel Choir will be in, teaching me how to sing. And the cast from Beauty and the Beast, that sounds awfully familiar, will be in to meet with us on Foodie and the Beast. That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday live right here on 1500 AM at 11.
And I can just read on the plane without any problem. Like now, when I'm on the airplane and somebody has a Kindle, they either have to turn on the light because a Kindle doesn't have any light built into it, or they also have these little small lights that clamp onto the side of the Kindle that lights it up because the Kindle is not a backlit screen. On the other hand, when I go to the swimming pool and there's bright sunlight, I cannot use the iPad.
Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Joe Applebaum of the Potomac Companies, and we have a fantastic lineup of guests for you today, including Sudhakar Shenoy, founder, CEO, and chairman of Information Management Consultants, Steve Biondi, president, North America of Micro Focus, Nicole Geller, founder and CEO of GCS, and John Marks, founder and president of Search for Common Ground. So let's get started. We'd like to introduce to you our first guest. He's a return guest, by the way. His name is Sudhakar Shenoy, and Sudhakar is the founder, CEO, and chairman of Information Management Consultants, otherwise known as IMC. So welcome back to the show, Sudhakar.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And tell us, what is IMC?
IMC is a systems integration company. We do a lot of work with the federal government and also large commercial organizations. We bring certain types of expertise to the table, and one of them is, of course, document management systems and workflow solutions. We also do a lot of work on web-based applications for large organizations.
Give us an example of how you touch the everyday person, please.
Well, for example, we build interactive websites for large organizations. If you go to a bank, for example, you might react with the bank using their website, and we specialize in developing very complex web-based solutions also for large institutions.
So you make online banking easier for
us.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. When did you found your company?
In 1981.
Okay. And how big or small is the company now?
We have several hundred people here in the United States.
Wow. Why did you found a company?
It was a desire more to be on my own, to be my own boss.
So if you run a company, you are literally your own boss? You can just do whatever you want?
Well, that's what I thought it would be. And to be honest with you, I feel like I sit at the bottom of an inverted pyramid, if you will, and I work for everybody else. My clients, of course, are my bosses, and I have multiple ones, you know, both in the public sector and the private sector, and to a certain extent, people who work for the company, I actually work for them also, because they are the ones who produce our products, and so I feel like I have to make sure that they are taken care of, and that we do things that makes their life easy.
You also mentioned that you wanted to start IMC so that you could, quote, have freedom of expression, end
right.
quote. What does that mean?
Well, basically, you know, I like doing things my way, but not necessarily, you know, 100%. You know, I take in ideas from different people and listen to them, and then decide what's the best course of action.
Is that how you and your father related growing up?
Not really. My father was a very strict individual, and he made sure that we studied hard and did the right things and were properly disciplined when we strayed off the chosen path. You know, so as an example, he used to wake me up every day at 5 in the morning, and he expected me to be back home by 7 in the evening, you know, with school in between, and then hit the books. And back then, I resented it a lot. But later on in life, I realized that had he not done that, I would have probably been somewhere else.
Well, to that point, you had an aha taking an exam one day. Did you not?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, in where I come from, I come from India, everything is extremely competitive. You know, having hundreds of millions of people. So one of the best, one of the ways that you get into college is by sitting for a competitive exam. And I did sit for that exam. A couple of 100,000 students sit for that exam every year, and about 1,200 get in. And I was one of the lucky 1,200 who got into it. And I realize now that had he not been strict and had he not pushed us, I probably wouldn't have gotten in. And once you get in, of course, the rest falls in place.
Oh, what happened to your friends, those guys you were hanging with growing up?
Well, I tell you, I think I was the only one who got in that year out of about a dozen friends that I hung out with.
In fact, in the green room, you said, quote, my dad was right and I was wrong.
Yes.
End quote.
Well, we can publish that, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, when you talk about the education that your father instilled in you, how does that translate to your business success today?
Well, you know, I did my bachelor's in electrical engineering, and then I did my master's in electrical engineering, and then I did my MBA at the University of Connecticut. And, you know, I realized that education, you know, you oftentimes don't end up doing what you studied in school, in college. But what college and school teach you is a way to think, you know, and to make decisions and to logically put together a string of decisions so that you arrive at the right conclusion most of the times.
You mentioned, well, let's go back to growing up in India. You mentioned that it was really competitive, more competitive than the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just consider the fact, you know, when I, you know, as I told you, my dad used to get transferred from one city to another every 5 or 6, 7 years. Yeah. And I remember when I finally finished my 8th grade and came into another big city, there was a school there which was one of the best schools, and they asked me to take a test to get in and into 9th grade. The problem was that I had to take a test, and they only had 3 vacancies.
And how many people were vying for those vacancies?
A couple of hundred.
Wow.
And they gave you a test, and they interviewed you, and then you finally got in. So, you know, it's easier to get in the lower grades, yeah. You know, but as you come up, there are only a limited number of places. And, you know, it was a tough environment, and it still continues to be tough. Today, at the Indian Institutes of Technology, which are supposed to be some of the best in the world, a million students sit for a test for 5,000 places.
How did you deal with the stress and pressure of that as a young person?
I think I was just too naive. I didn't know there was stress. I figured I'd just go take the test. You know, and everybody basically, you know, were like, it's a luck of the draw. It wasn't a luck of the draw. They were tough exams. And, you know, I guess I was prepared for it. I didn't realize it. It's too young to really know that there was stress. You know, of course, if you didn't get into that school, there were other schools of lesser, quality, if you will, that I would have probably gotten into.
So you had mentioned that your goal was always to come to the U.S.
Yes.
Why?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked me that question because as a student in Calcutta, summer times used to be really hot, almost 120 degrees in the shade. And we were always looking for places where we could cool off. Of course, none of our homes had air conditioning. You know, it's not a rich country. But there was one place which had a beautiful reading room environment, air conditioned to the hilt, and, you know, had lots of books and magazines. And that was the United States Information Service. So some of us used to go and spend our afternoons, especially during, you know, after school and also during vacations and holidays at USIS. And they had every magazine that was produced in the United States. I would read Time magazine. I would read, you know, Forbes, Fortune, whatever was available at that time. And I tell you what, I mean, we would read those stories and say, wow, that's the country we want to go to.
In fact, you mentioned that, quote, all good things happen in the U.S.,
yes.
End quote. What were some of those things that you imagined happened in the U.S.?
I mean, for example, you know, we'd see books on beautiful cars, you know, and in India there would be just, at that time there was only one or two types of cars that were available. You know, of course, airline travel was very limited in India at that time, whereas the United States, you know, you'd read about all these new airplanes coming up and people traveling by air, and we'd see pictures of people having a good time at the beach and, you know, and stuff. And then, you know, there were books on universities. I used to read, you know, there were catalogs of all the different universities. And I'd open it up and look at them and say, wow, that's where I want to be.
So when you got here, life must have been really easy, right?
You know, there was a cultural shock, you know, just a little bit. But fortunately, I was educated in English, so my English was pretty good. And to give you a quick story, I don't know how much time we have,
please,
but I'll give
please.
You a quick story. In India, there's a very famous hotel called the Taj. And when I was in my senior year, a friend of mine and I went to eat there because it was a 5-star place. Very exclusive and very expensive. So we had saved up some money as students because we wanted to go there. And we saw this. We ordered a pizza. And they brought a slice of pizza. And they charged us about $3 for that slice,
yeah,
because this was a big 5-star place. Well, fast forward a few months, and I came to the United States, and four or five of my other buddies were with me. And we were on campus, and all the restaurants, all the student union, et cetera, was closed because we had to come a little bit early. So for dinner, the first night, we went to this place, and there was a pizza thing place just outside campus. And my friend said, do you know, let's go have a pizza. Who knows what a pizza is? And I said, I do. So I said, I had one at the Taj. So they said, okay, let's go. So we went in, and the waitress came, and I said, we were five of us, so I ordered 5 large pizzas. So the waitress said, are you sure you want 5 large pizzas? I said, yes. And all my friends said, really? 5 large pizzas? I said, listen, I had this pizza in India. It's only one slice, so don't worry about it. So a few moments later, she comes in with this humongous, you know, if you've been to Connecticut,
yes,
pizzas. And after that, I was never allowed to order food in a restaurant.
Well, it's been 31 years,
yes,
since you founded IMC.
Yes.
And so I'm guessing not only has this country been good to you, but you've been good to it, and you've been good to your employees as well. Would you give us the web address, please, for IMC?
It's www.imc.com.
Simple. Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Sudhakar Shenoy. Sudhakar is the founder, CEO, and chairman of Information Management Consultants, or IMC. I'd like to thank my co-host, Joe Applebaum of the Potomac Companies, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about executive leaders just like Sudhakar. And Joe and I will be back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Rick Palmer.
Rick, who are you with?
I'm the Vice President of Business Development with Integrity Management Consulting.
What is Integrity Management Consulting?
Integrity is a rapidly growing small business here in McLean. And we're proud to be ranked as one of the top fastest growing companies in the local area and in the state of Virginia.
What kind of work do you do, in just a few words?
We do acquisition planning and program management support.
For the federal government?
For the federal government.
Okay. Now, you're not here really to talk too much about what Integrity does. You're here to do some celebrating. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
What are you celebrating?
Well, we've just been named one of Virginia's Fantastic 50 Companies for 2012. We're one of the fastest-growing companies in the state of Virginia, and we're going to be receiving that award very shortly.
Tonight?
Yes.
Fantastic. You're also one of the 7 precious jewels?
Yes, we were just named one of Consulting Magazine's 7 Small Jewels for 2012 as one of the fastest-growing companies in the area.
But we're not done yet, are we?
No, absolutely not.
There was one more thing you were going to celebrate.
We have a good nationwide presence, and particularly in the southwestern United States. We just opened a field office in Fort Worth, Texas, where a lot of our business is.
You're able to accomplish all these things because you're able to focus and compete effectively in a full and open environment. How are you able to do that, in a few words?
Well, how we're able to do that is just the fact that we evolved our company very, very quickly. The founders and the owners did that, and quite honestly, we just did not attempt to do all things all at the same time, focused on some great areas, and built the business where we could.
We've been speaking with Rick Palmer of Integrity Management Consulting, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Joe Applebaum of the Potomac Companies, and we are thrilled to introduce to you our next guest. His name is Steve Biondi. Steve's the president of North America for Micro Focus. So welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks,
and
Mike.
You're welcome. And tell us, what is Micro Focus?
Micro Focus is a software development company that allows people to take existing applications on the mainframe and make them more agile for today's environments.
Why is that important work?
Well, it's important because people don't realize that old systems, and I hate saying the word old because it's not really old, legacy systems mm-hmm. house most of today's global information. Mm-hmm. And as a result, when you go to the bank, you want to make sure that you can get access to your data. When you go and pay bills, you want to make sure that that happens. You know, cable listings, everything that touches your life is housed on a computer somewhere, and we have ability to make that data easily accessible to everyone.
If you were not doing this work, what would the difference be in my life, let's say, if I'm going to the bank? How would it be more difficult to do these things?
So our software allows big companies to make sure that their data is always accessible and always ready. So if our systems weren't in place, it's likely that you'd have delays. Imagine if you're standing at the ATM and you put in your card, and instead of 2 seconds, it takes 10 minutes. Would you go to the ATM? Probably not.
No.
We help you do that.
That's awesome. Thank you very much, by the way, for all of us. Thank you very much. How big or small is Micro Focus?
Micro Focus is about 1,200 people worldwide.
And the company's been around for how long?
About 35 years.
Is that how long you've been the president of North America?
No, I've just started here. I was announced as president December 1st, 2011.
Actually, you're so young looking, I'm not even sure you're 35 years old. But that was sort of a setup question. Why you? You've been in the job for less than a year now. I'm sure there were lots and lots of qualified people. What did they see in you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The chairman came over and invited me to dinner, and the chairman said, look, people in the past have had great skills and great contributions to this company, but the thing we've kind of lacked was some level of focus and some level of discipline. Based on your resume, Steve, we think you'll be able to bring to us a way to get the kind of structure and discipline in this company that we think will get us to the next level.
In fact, I think the chairman also identified you as a general manager type. Is that right?
That's right.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, in that context, it's how do you take the skills that you have on the table and enable them and empower them to do their very best, right? And that, and I'm not saying that in the past it hadn't happened,
right.
But I've been fortunate in my career to have the ability to bring out the best in people.
He saw that, and he saw that as a gift you had.
I think so.
Where did you learn that from?
You know, it's funny. Growing up, my father was always my father was a contractor, built houses, and I did worked with him in the summers and weekends when I was a kid growing up, and he always made it a point to say, plan your work and work your plan. And if you bring to mind the fact that you should always be conscious of what you're doing and why you're doing it, that's an important attribute. And that's a skill I learned very young, and I think that falls through today. And I think general managers have that kind of capability.
Is working for your dad, or was working for your dad, just a fantastic experience, a big pain because there was so much pressure or something else? What was it like?
You know, he grew up in the Depression, so he had a very different mindset than parents today, perhaps. Right?
What was his mindset?
His mindset was, you work every day. You make a contribution every day because you don't know when your next paycheck's going to come. So working hard and a strong work ethic was paramount.
He also said something to you about working inside. How did that go with you?
Yeah. So, you know, he working outside his whole life and being a contractor or a builder, you know, you have to be you're exposed to the elements all the time, right? And he always made it a point to say, look, whatever you do, work inside. Working outside is tough on your body. It's tough on you. So he always impressed to me the fact that, you know, whatever skills you have, try to parlay that into something inside, and maybe life will be pretty good for you.
Does this mean your dad was unhappy with his job, or he just wanted something different and better for his son?
I think it was the latter. I think he was very conscious of all his children to trying to make it better for them. And not that, you know, we weren't wealthy or anything like that, but if he enabled you to go do better, he succeeded, and I think he succeeded. He was very conscious of that.
What did an inside job mean to you beyond just obviously working inside versus outside.
You know, when he first brought it up, Mike, I don't know what he meant. I interpreted exactly what you just described, whereas, you know, how do you build inside? Should I go, you know, build kitchens and you know, refinish bathrooms and things like that versus, you know, what eventually he meant was you don't want to be working a hardworking guy your whole life because that's just hard. And believe me, I love that trade. I have great respect for people in that trade. But he felt that it was his job and obligation to prepare me to go do something other than that.
And that materialized for you when?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Probably the end of my high school time, I had the ability to. So IBM was out fishing for people who had skills, were good with their hands, and had a car. And they came to my school and they interviewed and they liked me. So they offered me an opportunity to go work as a maintenance man in IBM. You know, starting immediately. And I went home and talked to my parents and I said, what do you think? And they said, that's the job. That's what you should do. So it became real at that point in time.
Well, when you say maintenance man, what do you mean by that?
So in IBM, back in the early 80s, they had people that would work on furniture and fixtures, fixtures meaning light fixtures or plumbing fixtures or what have you, and just make sure that the infrastructure of buildings worked well. So I was in a building that IBM owned in Tarrytown, New York, and my job was to work on furniture and fixtures to make sure the place kept working.
So in some ways, you were doing exactly what your dad was doing, just literally inside.
Yeah, exactly right. So in hindsight, that's his dream for me came real right then.
When did you transition from an inside job working with your hands to an inside job working more with your mind?
Yeah.
Let's say.
So early on in my maintenance career, one of the people that I was working with made it a point. He said, look, you're working for the biggest computer company on the planet, right? Take advantage of that. So I was going to school at night to get my degree in computer science so that I could get out of maintenance and get into computer science. And probably about three or four years into the maintenance gig, an opportunity came up to go work as a computer operator off shift for IBM in one of their White Plains locations.
Why is it that people have said you have a Forrest Gump-esque element to your life? You don't look like Tom Hanks.
Well, you know, I think the context there was being lucky and being in the right place at the right time.
For example,
I'm a maintenance man, and yet I'm going to school at night to get my computer science degree. An opportunity arises in computer operations, and I get the job versus a college kid, right? You know, who has computer science degree, for example, because I'm already in. That was a stretch of good luck and good fortune.
Agreed. And I'm guessing that good luck did not get you to be the president of North America for Micro Focus. So, what else?
Sorry to interrupt you, Mike, but I think, you know, it's all about the work ethic. If you're really committed and passionate about what you do, right? Socrates had a saying, I'd rather train a zealot than raise a corpse, right? So if you're really fired up about what you're doing every day and working hard, I think the opportunities will present themselves.
So you've got an inside job. Is that mean you work less or it's easier work than an outside job? Is that what you're saying?
It's different. I work as many hours as it takes to get the job done. And the job is to make sure that we make our customers as successful as possible with our stuff.
What's one really hard thing about being a senior executive or a president? What's really hard about it?
Yeah, you know, probably the hardest thing that I've had to do is go through attrition exercises. When, you know, during the early 90s in IBM, for example, we had a lot of reduction of staff that had to occur.
That means you had to fire people.
That means I had to fire people.
Tell us what is that like?
Yeah, you know, there is nothing fun about that. There is nothing fun about that. What you end up having to do is, and it's not that the company's bad, and it's not that the company's, trying to be mischievous. They come to you and say, we can only afford 50% of the people on your team.
How many people were on your team?
There were 70, 7-0.
You had to fire 35 people.
Yes.
So what happened?
So what you do is you go through saying, you know, who could maybe be placed in another job.
That's so what you did.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So you take a look at your portfolio. You know, you hate saying it this way, but you look at the folks on the team, and you say to yourself, who are the people that are most likely able to get hired more quickly than others? Right, and it's not to say that other people are good or bad or whatever, but some people have an aptitude to go out and get a job immediately, and some people don't. So you want to be at the end of the day, they're your people, right? Yeah. They're family, and to have to do any of this is very, very difficult. So you take in mind who are the people that can stay behind and get the job done, and who are the people that you think can be successful elsewhere, and then you try to help them.
Yeah. What's the most significant thing you've done in the 8 or 9 months that 8 months that you've been president, in just a few words?
All right. So Micro Focus has a niche offering, right? We work on legacy systems, older systems, and make that data up there more accessible and more agile, right? That's a finite group of customers and people. So what I've done is the company came after me and said, look, we have challenges with marketing. We have challenges with channel partners. We have challenges with our coverage. So I think the most significant thing I've done is we have a lot of smart, capable salespeople that have been selling in swim lanes, right? So you and I could be on the same team, but we compete against each other because of how we're getting paid. I've eliminated all that. I've had people in teams now. We're going in, you know, pack hunting versus individual hunting. And I think as a result, the energy level has increased. We're going to have a lot more smart people solving smart and complex problems. And I think as a result, we're going to do much, much better.
Fantastic. Would you give us the web address for Micro Focus?
Yeah, it's www.microfocus.com.
Perfect. Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Steve Biondi. Steve is the president of North America for Micro Focus. I'd like to thank my co-host, Joe Applebaum of the Potomac Companies, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders just like Steve. And we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Mike Harden.
Mike, who are you with?
I'm with Vistage International.
What is Vistage?
Vistage is by far the largest and probably the most prestigious organization of CEOs in the world. We have about 15,000 members in 16 different countries.
And what does Vistage do?
Vistage is there specifically to help people get better at what they do at the CEO level. Our goal is to help CEOs become better decision makers, to grow their businesses, to do more with what they've got.
And what do you do at Vistage?
Well, I'm a chair with Vistage, and a chair simply means that I chair a local group of chief executive officers, and I coach each of those people individually and try to make myself available to help them with their business needs.
Why is coaching so important to a CEO? Don't they have it all figured out?
I wish they did. I'd been a CEO myself for a long time, and I wish I'd had a coach. There's just too much going on in today's world. You're being pulled in all kinds of different directions. You're making decisions every day, and it's just so isolated for some people to have to make those decisions without the ability to go to other people.
There's a plethora of coaches out there. Why are you a fantastic CEO coach? Why you?
Well, I would say that what I do is I help good CEOs become great CEOs. And what I do with that is I have certain axioms of business that I try to stress. And one of the first ones is that you deserve the people that you hire and keep.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, if you have A players on your staff, they're going to do a great job for you, and you deserve to have them. If you have B players, well, then you deserve to have B players.
So you're looking for what type of person?
I look for CEOs who are lifelong learners, who want to be better at what they do, and need someone like me to help them get there.
How do we find you, Mike?
Well, I have a blog, and most CEOs look at that. It's called CEOSuccessCoach.com.
We've been speaking with Mike Harden of Vistage and CEOSuccessCoach.com. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Joe Applebaum of the Potomac Companies, and we are really excited to introduce to you our next guest. Her name is Nicole Geller. Nicole is the founder and CEO of GCS. So welcome to the show, Nicole, and tell us, what is GCS?
Thanks so much for having me. GCS is a professional service and solutions provider located in Tyson's Corner, and we do acquisition lifecycle management, program management, performance improvement consulting, contract support services, and in short, we really help drive efficiency and transparency in government programs.
In what way does that touch the average person out there?
We help save taxpayers money.
Like the sound of that. Can you give us an example?
Yes, on a $6 billion enterprise-wide IT program, we're able to design special ordering systems that actually brought ordering processing time down from 180 days to 40 days. There's real savings all over the place with that.
So in other words, it took the federal government 180 days to do something.
Yes.
You helped them figure out how to do it in 40 days?
That's correct.
And how much money does that save us, the taxpayer?
Millions.
Wow. Well, thank
millions
you.
Every year.
On behalf of our listeners, thank you very much. How long has the company been around doing that?
Since 1995. And we really started as a staffing company at that point, and then in 2003 transitioned to government contracting.
And so today you have how many people?
175 employees and growing.
Wow, congratulations. You mentioned you were born an entrepreneur?
Yes.
What does that mean?
It means that I wanted to be an entrepreneur from the earliest ages and really looking at everything. How can I build a better mousetrap with pretty much anything that I come into contact with?
Give us an example.
An example is at a nursery that I worked at when I was, you know, probably about 14 years old. And we had a great traffic pattern that would run by the shop, and saw that as an opportunity to really display all kinds of plants and drive sales. So I went outside, put together a big display, created some signs, and really drove some traffic and revenue to this nursery.
So when you were growing up and doing these things, did your friends think you were normal?
No.
What did they think?
Square peg in a round hole.
And how does that relate to your days now as a CEO? Is it the same thing? Are you a square peg in a round hole today?
I think now I don't feel like I'm a square peg, but I certainly did growing up. Now those things that may have been a little bit different growing up really can benefit a lot of people now.
Did you get discouragement from people growing up saying, hey, you know, stop worrying about cash flow with the nursery. Let's go, you know, go out with your friends or something like that?
Yeah, I really felt that, you know, in a conventional kind of school setting, felt that, because I always want to question, well, how does that work? Can we change this? Can we look at it this way? And that wasn't maybe ideally suited for that environment.
Who encouraged you growing up?
Parents and mentors.
Were your parents entrepreneurs?
No. I actually come from a family of no entrepreneurs, but they did say, hey, you know, go do what you want to do. You've got a talent there. Go for it. Explore it.
When did they first identify the talent?
I think really probably the first year of high school, my mom enrolled me in a junior achievement, and I just loved it.
So when you say they saw the talent, the talent for what exactly?
The talent really for improving things, wanted to sell things, wanted to improve the lives of people through improvements. And they were really encouraged me to work early on because they could see that just made me happy.
Is that what an entrepreneur is to you, all of those characteristics you just described?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd add probably one more, and that's working in teams and bringing out the best in other people, too. Entrepreneurs have a vision or the talent and bringing out the best, and I think that's an important component, too. You don't do it by yourself.
And you had all of those things at the very latest when you were 14, if not earlier than that.
I wouldn't say, you know, some of the things like working with teams, you know, develop over the years and through coaching and seeing where the successes are. So even as an entrepreneur, you're constantly working and improving how you do the entrepreneur side of things.
Yeah. Does that mean being an entrepreneur and being the CEO of an organization, you were an excellent student when you were growing up?
Actually, quite the contrary. I was not a bad student, but I certainly wasn't excelling. But I loved learning, and perhaps my learning just wasn't in the conventional sense.
In what sense was your learning?
Pretty voracious. Love reading, love learning new things. I probably, you know, took lessons in every sport known to man, and really enjoyed that.
And does that continue today with your learning?
Oh, yeah. I probably read about you know, 15 to 20 magazines a month. Love getting inputs. Love the blogs. Still pretty voracious reader.
You mentioned in the green room that these differences you identified when you were young, you downplayed them. What did you mean by that?
Meant that that's not how most people thought. It wasn't always received well, and not always encouraged, and that in a conventional setting, this was a little unconventional. So I learned to downplay it.
Do you think it was unconventional because you're a woman?
Partially, yes.
Where did you get your encouragement from besides your parents? You mentioned getting kudos growing up from other places.
Yeah, I think in some of the work settings and the jobs that I had and saw success, like the nursery I spoke about and some other things that I did, those successes really helped fuel that. And I also say, you know, along the way, I had some mentors that encouraged me to keep going. And I sought out mentors as well.
When did you stop feeling like a square peg in a round hole?
I think, you know, with GCS, probably a couple years into it, after, you know, we were generating revenue and then I could see that people really wanted and needed the service and we were really filling a need in the marketplace.
So you're telling us that through all those years, you still felt like a square peg in a round hole?
Yeah, I did. It really didn't come until later. To be honest,
what was the key that unlocked this new feeling now, and how would you describe the feeling?
I think that, you know, it evolved over the years, and one being comfortable with the notion that, hey, this is how my mind works, and this is something I bring to the table along with all the other skill sets everyone else brings. You know, certainly worked with over the years with coaches to figure out, all right, what is it that I do bring to the table, and to be able to feel good about that talent. And honestly, that just came with years of success in the business and hearing from customers that they really liked what we were doing and we were on the right track. It made a difference in their projects and in various other areas.
Yeah. If you were to look back on your life and say, I would do this differently as it relates to feeling less like a square peg in a round hole, is there anything you would do differently or do sooner?
Yes, I think that I would, you know, trust my instincts earlier on, and then just really fill in the blanks or the holes with others with great talent, but to trust my instincts more.
Is there a particular instinct you wish you had trusted earlier on, and what would that have been?
Well, that's, you know, a tough question, but I think that instinct is probably could translate to confidence.
Yeah.
And a confidence in that particular decision or that risk. Being an entrepreneur, a lot is about risk, taking calculated risks, and feeling comfortable with those. I do have that ability, and I think had I had more confidence, I probably would have done some of the things quicker.
Wow. Well, what's the hardest thing you've ever had to do, Nicole?
This is going to sound a little bit different than probably, you know, some of the things we have been talking about, but that's about being a leader. And being really authentic in leading. And one of the things that was very difficult was actually always had a sense of how do you operate as a CEO, and there's a certain demeanor and decorum to that. And part of this confidence that I talked about was, all right, I'm going to really just be authentic to who I am as a person and begin running it that way. And that was just such a departure, but very difficult to do, but very happy when I made that transition.
What is one element of your personality or your leadership style now that's more authentic compared to before?
Really passionate. If I'm really passionate about something, I'm going to show it and not curtail that. Really bring energy. And then also, same with, you know, the emotions that may come out in any given situation.
Yeah.
Not crazy emotion, obviously, but the ability to show that authentically and not kind of detach from that. And it's really, I think, been kind of a freeing, much funner experience.
Would you give us the web address for GCS, please, Nicole?
Absolutely. www.gcsinfo.com.
Right, one more time. I don't want anyone to miss it.
www.gcsinfo.com.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Nicole Geller. She is the founder and CEO of GCS. I'd like to thank my co-host, Joe Applebaum, with the Potomac Companies for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders, just like Nicole. And Joe and I will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight.
Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380 or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Joe Applebaum, of the Potomac Companies, and we are really excited to introduce to you our final guest of the day. His name is John Marks. John is the founder and president of Search for Common Ground. So, John, welcome to the show, and tell us, what is Search for Common Ground?
Search for Common Ground is a nonprofit. We're the largest nonprofit or NGO working in the field of conflict resolution around the world. We have offices in 30 countries and about 425 employees.
Can you give us an example of the work you do?
We try to end violence. We try to prevent it. We do everything from a lot of TV production. We make soap opera in 17 countries. We do roundtables. We bring people together from across political divides. We work with youth. We work with young people. But it's all within the context of understanding the differences and acting on the commonalities.
Wow. And you've been doing this, again, for how long?
I founded the organization 30 years ago.
And you've got 425 people doing this with you?
Yes.
Wow. Back 30 years ago, you had a vision. What was the vision?
The vision was that the world needed to find better ways of dealing with conflict, and that if you could resolve conflict in a win-win fashion, in a non-adversarial fashion, it would be a lot more productive and a lot more beneficial than trying to do it through dominance or win-lose kind of methodologies.
What was happening in the world at that time?
Well, at that point, the Cold War was raging. There was a feeling that the world might blow itself up. The U.S. and the Soviets were facing each other as the enemy. And we said, and it wasn't a popular idea at the time, that the world would be much better off if they stood together and took on ending the threat as a shared problem.
That's remarkable work, this vision that you had. Did that start in childhood?
I always was interested in international affairs and foreign policy. In fact, my first job at 22 is I went into the Foreign Service. And so I was interested. I didn't have this consciousness at that point. I was just a person who I kind of came in on the tail end of the Kennedy idea of ask not what you can do for your country. Ask not what you can do In other words,
that's not what you can do
what
yourself.
You can for your country. I've got the quotes wrong. But the Kennedy idealism that you could be committed, and that was driving me. But I didn't have the ideas that became the essence of Search for Common Ground until I got up into my 30s.
Yeah. What role did your father or your mother play in your desire to create this organization to help conflict resolution?
Yeah. My father was a highly successful entrepreneur. He built the largest insurance agency in America, and he had to drop out of school during the Depression to support his parents. And I inherited, I believe, his entrepreneurial skills, but luckily for me, I grew up a middle-class kid, perhaps an upper-middle-class kid, and I didn't have to make those kinds of financial sacrifices, if you will. But I had the talents from my father, and I think I inherited that more than anything else from him.
Yeah. Yet you said that going into the Foreign Service was an act of rebellion. How so?
My father wanted me to go into his insurance business. He wanted me to be his son and his partner. And a lot of it was his self-preservation, in the sense, because he knew when he was 65, if he didn't have a relative as a partner, he would become redundant in the field. And he wanted me very much to do it because he wanted what he had built to stay in the family, and he wanted to be able to keep working. And I wasn't interested, frankly. I wanted to go out and see the world and change it.
Was it difficult to tell your dad that?
We fought about it probably for about 10 years. And when I started Search for Common Ground, he said, you can't afford to do this. You should go out and get a job.
Tell us a bit about the zeitgeist, if you will, of the times back during the early Kennedy administration. And personalize it. How did you feel back then?
I felt that there was something beyond life to selling insurance or selling razor blades, and that I wanted to be engaged in the world. I wanted to do something meaningful with my life. That was what was driving me all those years.
Well, now that you've created this wonderful organization, could you tell us your most meaningful work? I know there's many, but you told us in the green room that there was one specific with regard to Rwanda.
Well, I'd like to put on the top of that list what we've been able to accomplish in Burundi. Burundi was on the brink of genocide, just as Rwanda, which is next door with the same ethnic mix, had a genocide. And we went in 1995, and it lasted, for our involvement, very seriously for about the next 5 or 6 years. And I think we played a profound part in keeping the country from going over the brink and winding up, as Rwanda had wound up, in a genocidal situation.
Would you take us behind the scenes? And you're in a room with people, leaders of organizations that on some level are embittered towards one another. What do you do?
Well, one thing we perceived, one of the big problems in Rwanda had been that the radio, it was called Hate Radio. And
Hate Radio.
Hate Radio. And it had been encouraging people to kill each other. In other words, it had been a tool in ethnic warfare. And we decided that we would start something to counter Hate Radio. Well, the opposite of Hate Radio is not Love Radio. But we set up a radio which was sort of Common Ground Radio, which brought people together from the two sides. We did everything from a lot of soap opera to the news to music. We had cultural programming. At the peak, we were doing 15 hours a week of broadcasting with both Hutu and Tutsi journalists and reporters. They were the ethnic groups. And the whole thing of it was bringing those people into a meaningful media relationship and having the radio reflect their common ground, not their differences.
When you show up in a country, are you welcomed by people saying, oh, we're so glad you're here to help us resolve our differences, or is it back off and get out?
Usually we can find people who will welcome us. In other words, it's not universal. Sometimes we go in at an invitation, or sometimes we create our local partners. But there's always somebody in the country who thinks this is a good idea.
Yeah. Are there situations, or tell us about one situation where it could have gone either way? It was on the brink of maybe just completely dissolving and something terrible happening?
Well, it happened to us in Angola. Angola, we went into because we thought the civil war was coming to an end, and we went in, and within about a year or two, the civil war got worse than ever. It became almost impossible to move, and many of the NGOs, non-governmental organizations, were pulling out. But we had a perception that we probably should stay, because if we don't stay when the times are tough, as they improve, you know, we're going to not have a role.
So when you say stay, you lived in Angola for 2 years.
Well, I didn't. I had employees who lived in Angola. I live in Washington, D.C. Okay. But the only place, after 9/11, my wife and I work with my wife.
Yes.
She's a senior vice president.
Yes.
The two of us decided that Jerusalem was the center of the conflict in the world, or the biggest conflict in the world. And we moved to Jerusalem for 2 years after 9/11. And we ran both the Jerusalem office and the organization, which was made possible by a seven-hour time difference. In other words, we ran Jerusalem during the day and the whole organization during the night.
Have you ever felt personally threatened?
Sure.
Give us an example.
Well, I've been in situations where people are shooting at each other. I remember once in crossing from the Israeli side to the Palestinian side, and there was tear gas shooting up above, and there were soldiers shooting other people, and it wasn't fun. Nobody was shooting at me, but in a situation like that, you can sometimes get in the way.
So why did you not just say, you know what, enough is enough, and I'm out of here. I'm going to save my own skin.
Well, I don't take risks that are stupid, but this is what I do, and that was I crossed and I got out of the way, and that's what I do.
Does that mean you know no fear, or you just deal with the fear and press on?
Yeah, it's this is my job. This is what I do, and I'm not fearless. I've had the bejesus scared out of me. But for the most part, I avoid that. And usually when you're on the ground in the middle of something, it's much less fear-inducing than reading about it in the newspaper. I was in Libya about 4 months ago.
I'm so sorry to interrupt. You said it's much less fear-inducing?
Yeah.
In other words,
being there is not – usually there are people going along. I said I was in Libya about 4 months ago, and Libya is a place that if you read the newspapers, you get scared. There's supposed to be a lot of militia activity. Well, I ran into a lot of traffic jams, and there were people who were going about their business. And usually when you're in a place, I'm not saying there isn't violence, but it usually is not something that you have a sense of unless you're absolutely in the middle of it.
The most meaningful contribution you would like to make moving forward before you leave this earth is what?
I'd like to change the way the world deals with conflict. I'd like to become a global figure. I'd like the ideas that I have to take on a huge currency so they run the way governments and individuals interact with each other.
Would you give us the web address for Search for Common Ground, please?
It's www.sfcg.org. In other words, Search for Common Ground, www.sfcg.org.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with John Marks. John is the founder and president of Search for Common Ground. I'd like to thank all of our guests today, including Sudhakar Shenoy, founder, CEO, and chairman of Information Management Consultants, or IMC, Steve Biondi, president North America of Microfocus, Nicole Geller, founder and CEO of GCS, and of course, most recently, John Marks, founder and president of Search for Common Ground. I'd like to thank my co-host, Joe Applebaum of the Potomac Companies, for helping me with the interview. More than anyone else, I'd like to thank you, our listening audience. If it weren't for you, we would not even have a radio show. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you to the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce for hosting us. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders, just like John. And until next week, have a fantastic week. We will see you again. And this is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, signing off. Goodbye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers.